Before we get to the interview, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk with you about a need we have. As we've mentioned in the middle of our podcasts for the last few months, we're working on a project to raise a little over $20,000 this year to help us conduct small church pastor workshops in Indonesia, Malaysia, Austria, Switzerland, and Germany. So far, we've received about $15,000 through your generosity. Now, once we're on the ground in these places, most of the costs for food, transportation, and housing will either be very minimal or will be provided by local churches, so the bulk of the costs are to help us get there. It's for airline fares. So, here's our current challenge. In September, we leave for Malaysia and Europe, but we need to buy the airline tickets now, and the funds we currently have are approximately $5,000 short. So, if you can help, go to karlvaters.com/support and donate any amount you're able to. And please be sure to give us your contact info so we can thank you for your generosity.
And I realized that what my grief needed was room. It needed space to be as it was, to be as painful as it was, to be seen, to be recognized, to be allowed.
Hi, I'm Karl Vaters, and welcome to The Church Lobby, Conversations on Faith and Ministry. My guest in this episode is Leanne Friesen, and we're going to talk about grief. Specifically, we'll talk about how we as pastors can help give people the room to process the grief they go through when they're dealing with a profound loss, and we'll talk about how to process those feelings when we have loss as well. Leanne is a former pastor, and she's the author of Grieving Room, Making Space for All the Hard Things After Death and Loss. I'll be talking with her about the difficult but important principles she learned as she went through the death of her own sister more than a decade ago, and it can help us as well. And don't forget to stick around when the interview is done. I'll come back with some thoughts about how to face walking people through grief and being able to process our own feelings that get stirred up when we're helping others deal with grief. Well, Leanne Friesen, welcome to the Church Lobby. It's good to have you here today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, you and I, before we get to the main conversation that everybody else will be interested in, I want to talk about something that maybe only you and I will be interested in.
Absolutely.
And that is, we were both born in the very close together in the same part of the world, not the same town, but on the same island of Newfoundland off the coast, off the east coast of Canada.
Which is so exciting. And Newfoundlanders absolutely love to find one another. And you meet another Newfoundlander and you say, are you related to this one? Are you related to that one? Who do you know? And for anyone listening, we've already done that.
Yeah.
And we've had a great time.
Yeah, we have. We have. You actually grew up on the island. Mm-hmm. I was born there and moved away to actually where you are now, to Hamilton, where both my sisters were born. So we've got multiple geographical connections here. And it is because these are not places where a lot of people are from. These are not heavily populated areas.
It's hard to explain how random this is. So it's very, very cool. We'll still let you claim Newfoundlander status. Absolutely.
Thank you. That is one of the things that everybody who goes to Newfoundland loves about it. It is one of the friendliest places. It's got a unique culture. Like, I still have yet to find proper words to describe to non-Newfoundlanders what the Newfoundland culture is like. But the people are extraordinarily friendly, extraordinarily welcoming, but it's also like, in some ways, like landing on a different planet. The accent is like nowhere else in the world. The culture is very different. And it's one of these places where people probably ought to visit more often than they do, because it really is a wonderful experience to go there.
Yeah, everyone should go. You won't hear as much accent left with me. Now, I'm told, of course, as soon as I get talking to my parents, my siblings, or as soon as my feet hit the ground, it comes back in spades. But what sometimes happens to me is someone will go, were you American? And they'll pick up on a couple of words. Mm-hmm. And there's this little bit of nuance. So you might hear a little bit sneaking in here and there.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hearing more of a mainland Canadian accent than a Newfoundland accent from you. Yeah.
We call everywhere else mainlanders, which my husband takes great offense at, because he grew up on Vancouver Island, which was literally 4,000 kilometers from me. So as far apart as we could be in this giant country. And my mother always calls him a mainlander. And he's like, I grew up on an island.
Yeah, a smaller island than Newfoundland, by the way. Yeah. Again, one of the very interesting cultural things that makes a Newfoundland unique is their way of identifying things and so on is very, very special. So anyway, that was of interest to us. Now we'll get to the stuff that might that
Absolutely.
will be of interest to others as well. You have written a book that I really enjoyed, isn't the right word, although I did. But I got a great deal out of and really appreciate it, and I believe will be a great benefit to a whole lot of the folks we talk to. It's called Grieving Room, Making Space for All the Hard Things After Death and Loss. And since the main audience for this podcast is pastors, we're often walking people through periods of grief, but we're not immune to grief ourselves, which of course you are not, which was the inspiration for the book. So start by giving us some understanding of where this book came from out of your own life experiences.
Of course, this book came from a whole bunch of different things, but the main connection that, of course, will come out immediately in the book is I was a griever, and continue to be a griever. When I was 35, just over a decade ago now, my eldest sister, Roxanne, died after 8 years of fighting melanoma. And I was thrust into just such a deep and profound grief. Now, what might be relevant to some of your listeners is I was a pastor at the time and had been a pastor for nearly a decade. And not only was I a pastor, but I was actually a pastor who had for a long time actually had a lot of interest in grieving, had done some extra training on grief, on lament, and all those things in the church. It was a topic that was important to me. And I often say, I thought I would have a leg up on grief. I thought I would have kind of that extra knowledge. I was prepared and I was completely derailed. So I went through grief as a pastor. And was suddenly seeing all the things that I had experienced with other people as a pastor on their journey with new eyes. And then thinking about all the people that I would now be supporting as grievers and what I had to learn, what I'd had to experience, which extended not just being a pastor, but as a human. And the title that I ended up coming up with for this book was Grieving Room, of course, reminiscent of this term, breathing room. We often talk about needing breathing room. And realizing that as a griever, I needed room for my grief. And much of our preconceived notions are that grievers want to feel better, that grievers need to be fixed, whether we would use that term intentionally or not, that grievers need some solutions. And certainly as pastors, we want to be able to offer that to people or as anyone supporting someone in grief and as grievers. And I realized that what my grief needed was room. It needed space. To be as it was, to be as painful as it was, to be seen, to be recognized, to be allowed. So, after a number of years, this book came to be as I reflected more on that. I began with an Instagram page. I run an Instagram page called @grieving.room, which has a really large community there, sharing little thoughts on grief. And this idea, you just felt the resonance over and over. And it ultimately turned into this book, which I always say is part memoir, but part grief survival guide. So I use my story, but really it's meant to be this picture of ways we can give grief room. Each chapter is a different type of room that grief needs. We need room for rage. We need room for regret. We need room to never get over it. All these pieces.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that really struck me and I appreciated right off the bat about the book. It's perfectly named because it is about providing room for grieving. And one of the things I appreciated right away was, as you reflected already, I don't think we handle grief well in our culture. And I think maybe I'm over-idealizing it, but there seems to me in my study of history that there were times in a pre-technological age, maybe, where we naturally leaned into relationships because there was no TV to watch, there was no internet to hang on. So you spent time sitting around with friends and family and telling stories and remembering people. And I think in that setting, there is a more natural place to grieve. And they had ceremonies and rituals and times that we think somehow it's we want to avoid. We want to get happy right away, and we don't allow for that to go through, which especially as Christians to me is weird because like Good Friday matters, right? We don't
Well
allow
said.
time for Good Friday because we want to get to Easter too quickly, but Easter doesn't mean anything if Good Friday isn't filled with grief.
That's so well said. I couldn't agree more. I often talk about us being a grief avoidant culture, and it's that assumption that to feel sadness or to feel grief is bad, that it's a negative emotion. even though we see all throughout scripture so much space for lament and grief and rage, even, and things that we want to quickly fix. Grieving hurts, it's painful, it's uncomfortable. So, of course, we want to get to the other side. And we do all kinds of things to try to avoid it, to try to avoid the yuckiness. You gave a good example, right? More and more. I know that, again, your podcast is focused to pastors. How many of you have had someone say, "We're not going to have a funeral, it'll be too sad"? That increased profoundly in my 20 years as a pastor, because there is this sense that somehow maybe we can skip the sadness. Or they'll say, "We're not going to call it a funeral, we're going to call it a celebration of life." And to be fair, call it whatever you want. But there's this kind of language of, because then people won't cry or they won't be sad. And we're trying to just get to the other side before we actually go through the road, before we go on the road, before we take the path. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, the only way to the quote unquote other side of grief is to grieve. And that's, we kind of want to find a way around it, but it's actually through grieving that we grieve. And so it makes sense that we want to do it. No one wants to feel those hard things, but we're not going to be able to skip it. And so, as you said, maybe in the past, or maybe even culturally in, North American culture, there is this sense that maybe we haven't really learned how to just sit with those uncomfortable emotions.
And this is, I think, for me, one of the primary premises of the book that I think will really be helpful to us. You talk about grief, and you actually chapter each title a different type of room that a need for grieving. So just to give people some sense of it, some of the chapter titles are Room to Be Uncertain, Room for the Grief Bubble. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Room for the Roller Coaster, Room for Rage. Check out the Psalms, folks. It's allowed. Right. And you go through, and it's 20 chapters, each one of a different type of room. And as you said, it's part memoir. You walk through your actual life story and your process of going through each of these things yourself, how it was challenging and how the Lord and others helped you get through that, the mistakes you made along the way, including making room for mistakes is one of the
Yeah,
premises that you
learning by
have here.
doing.
So what I'd love to do is just walk through some of the things that really stuck out to me that I think we can talk to our listeners about that can help them. And first of all, again, I want to remind pastors, you're probably primarily listening to this as a way to help others through their grief. And I fully understand that, and I know you're going to get that out of it. But I also want to talk to those who are experiencing their own grief, and maybe even some who have already done what Leanne talked about, whereas you have been grief avoidant for some of your own losses so far. And maybe this will be a reminder to pause and maybe even have to go back to address some things, because when we avoid grief, we avoid getting healthy, or we delay getting healthy, don't we?
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said that, because a lot of people do wonder if it's okay to make grieving room for things that sometimes happened a long time ago. And we need to do that as well. And sometimes we weren't in the space to process the grief when it happened. A common example is, Mom died, and my life was so busy. I had little kids at home. I was overwhelmed, and I don't know if I even grieved her. Or sometimes we lost a parent young, and we didn't really know what we lost until we got older. Or for any number of reasons, we felt like we didn't make space for the grief. And it's so common when I'm at events that I now lead or facilitate, and people will come up and say, Dad died 20 years ago, and all of a sudden I feel like I'm dealing with it for the first time. And I say, that's okay. So anyone listening, be it an old grief, a new grief, you can give room as you need, and I hope you'll find room for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's walk through some of those rooms. You start by talking about the anticipation of grief when, like, if you've got someone in your life and you know they're going to be dying, or maybe you're experiencing an impending divorce, something that you're going to be grieving over. But one of the things you say fairly early in, and now again, I'm going to give the quote direct from the book, we need room to say, she is dying, and to hear in response, I'm here for you. Talk through the two sides of that. Why is it so important to use, and not just to say it, but to use very plain, blunt words about it.
Well, that so speaks for my experience. And so, I was 35. I had this cherished, beloved sister dying in front of me. And I was so struck by how often I would share with well-meaning friends and well-meaning Christians, and they would just want to explain it away. So they would say things like, well, she might get better, or don't give up hope, or have faith, or God might still heal her. And the reality was why I had all that faith. When you hear that, it feels really invalidating. It can feel really difficult when what you're watching is someone literally dying before your eyes. And so the juxtaposition of, seeing your sister lying in bed covered in tumors, no longer able to speak coherently, suffering and with each turn that she made. And then you try to share with someone, I'm at a hospice. It could be any day now they're dying. They say, oh, don't say that. Don't focus on that. You just feel so alone. You feel so profoundly alone in that moment with this traumatic thing that you're trying to make space for. And it's done with good intentions. I often say to people, to be clear, I think you should follow the griever's lead. If I'm saying, but we're still praying for healing, my encouragement is to say, absolutely, I'll pray with you. And so I often say anything that you're saying to correct a griever is maybe where you can roll it back a bit. And we actually inadvertently try to correct our grievers and people suffering in many ways, right? So that's a good example. My sister's dying. Oh, don't say that. You know what? If that's what I've said, you can follow through with that, right? In the same way, I wouldn't recommend if they said, the doctors say she's dying, but I have hope. Maybe that's not the time to jump in and say, are you sure? Letting it be as what the person is in that moment. But I think being willing to say dying is so important. And again, we're so adverse to that culturally because there are times when people are dying and it is a profound life-altering experience for the living. And the nature of our modern culture is most of us haven't seen someone die and often haven't seen them die slowly. And the first time we go through that, it is an incredible experience to process. It is a meaningful experience. It is a painful experience. One of my dearest friends just lost a parent to cancer. And the weeks leading up to that, the amount of processing, just to process what they were seeing and experiencing, it is no simple thing. And so we need to make space to name things as they are. I was trying to process that my sister is about to die. And this is so hard to say. And so the ability of someone to say, I'm here for you. I'm going to journey with you. You're not going to be alone in this is so powerful. Now, in the book, I tell a story of something that was so meaningful to me. And I want to say we do all these things with good intentions, right? We have to show each other grace because sometimes I think people listen to these things, they go, I blew it. Oh, no. Da, 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 da. No, we're trying. We want to just keep learning, right? And I remember going back home because she was from Newfoundland. And, we're at the hospice every day, the palliative care hospital. And it's just shocking how we're watching her disappear before us. Traumatic, in fact. And I was talking to my sister's sister-in-law about this one day. And I said, I'm just so tired of everyone coming in and saying, maybe it'll change, maybe it'll get better. Like it just felt ludicrous. And she said, Oh, Leanne, you would have just loved the visit a couple of days ago when you weren't here before you got back. And she explained that a dear family friend who'd actually grown up in Zimbabwe came into the hospital room. And she said he walked into the room and he knelt at the foot of Roxanne's bed. That was my sister's name. And her words were, I've never forgotten it. And she said, Leon, he didn't pray for her to get better. He prayed her into glory. And it still means so much to me to think of that prayer. And as a pastor, I've told that story so many times. And I'll show up at deathbeds now, and people will say, pray them into glory, Leanne, pray them into glory. And the power of having a moment of saying, God, welcome this person home. Like we just pray for the moment with joy that we know that you are going to be there for them, even as our hearts are aching, even as they are breaking. Lord, be there. And we pray that you would receive them. And all the ability to name that was what I really needed in.
I've been in rooms like that as well. So for anybody who has not been in a room like that, because as you said, we don't experience death as firsthand in our culture as humans did for so many generations. And so it feels overwhelming. And the idea that you would somehow just sit with it like that and anticipate it like that and pray someone into glory rather than where's your faith that we're going to pray them out of the sickness and so on, that a lot of people are going to feel some discomfort with that. But I can confirm, as you have just confirmed, that the accepting of the situation is not a lack of faith. And the accepting of the situation allows people to begin the grieving process earlier and therefore I think process it better. You use the term anticipatory grief.
That's a common term, and I didn't make up that term. That's an important important term for grievers. And again, I want to reiterate, follow the lead in the room, right? And so even a safe pastoral tip is to say, I'm going to pray for you. Is there a way in particular you'd like me to pray? And rebuild, right? Some people don't want to be, they don't want to think about that, but being able to be discerning there is so important. And that's why, one of my counseling professor in seminary always said, when you go into these rooms, you pray for the Holy Spirit to give you wisdom. You pray for the Holy Spirit's wisdom. And I think about that often. But as you ask about the question, I've completely forgotten now. Remind me what the original question was.
Anticipatory grief.
This is such an important term. And often when I talk about it, people often go, oh, thank you for naming it. So anticipatory grief, again, which is a psychological term, a very real thing, is the idea of grieving for something that hasn't yet happened. And so anticipatory grief, your congregants are going through this. People who have loved ones that have dementia often have anticipatory grief. If someone's dying, they have anticipatory grief. And it's really complicated because they're grieving, but they're not yet grieving. And so what they're struggling with is this really painful reality. They're grieving because they're losing them slowly and they know what's coming, but they're also saying, but I shouldn't grieve yet because they're still here. Or why would I be sad now? They're here. Or, I don't want to miss anything. I don't want to be thinking about my grief while they're still here. Or is my grief now giving up on them? All those things are really complicated. But the reality is, when someone's dying, you do lose them slowly, right? So there's going to be the, if they're dying in this way, of course, there's sudden death, and those are so hard in different ways. But in a case like this, you have the first day that they don't talk, and you go farther back, right? And you have the day that you learn about the illness, the first time that they stop going to work, or the first time that they say, I'm going to leave the dinner table early, and I'm too tired tonight to watch my favorite movie, and your stomach sinks, and you go, it's happened, and I'm losing them bit by bit. One of my biggest moments was because I lived in Ontario, which is like kind of a little bit more to the, towards the middle of Canada, and then my sister lived way on the east side of Canada. There was the moment that I remember phoning her, and her husband answered the phone and said, she's not well enough to talk on the phone. And I realized I would never talk on the phone with my sister again. Was 2 months after that, but I never talked to her on the phone again. And that was a huge moment of anticipatory grief. The loss is coming little by little by little. And so we need that grief as well.
And the acknowledgement of the, again, nobody's going to do this perfectly, but the more we can acknowledge these things in a healthy way, I think the more healthy the whole thing becomes. Before we continue, I'd like to take less than a minute to mention three important items. First, if you're new to this podcast, it's a product of helping small churches thrive at karlvaders.com. We provide encouragement and resources for pastors of the 90% of churches that aren't big through workshops, books, articles, this podcast, and more. Second, our current project is to raise approximately $20,000 to help us conduct small church pastor workshops in Indonesia, Malaysia, Austria, Switzerland, and Germany in 2025, including translating and printing one of my books, The Grasshopper Myth, into the Indonesian language to give for free to 1,000 small church pastors. The churches that need our help can typically afford at the least, so if you'd like to help us do this, you can support us at karlvaders.com/support. And third, you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter and get all the latest resources and news at karlvaders.com/subscribe. Links for all of this will be in the show notes. Now, back to my interview. But we talked about the mistakes we made, and I want and you have been very gracious about that, as you are in the book. And one of the things you say is, in the valley there is indecisiveness, and you actually use the phrase, at one point everything seemed like the wrong thing. So how do you walk through that?
Grievers in that anticipatory phase, in that dying season, but actually after they die too. And you have those moments as you're newly grieving, you actually don't know what the right thing to do is. You're constantly saying, is this the right thing? Is this the person who should speak at the funeral? I don't know. Is that what they would have wanted? I don't know. Is that the song they would have wanted? Maybe. Should we have this meal catered or should we have a different one? Should we have it this day or that day? And even if everything's laid out about what they might want for a funeral, for example, you still second guess yourself. And then as you go along, you're going to have the moments of, would they want me to do this in their memory? Would they have wanted our daughter to go to this school? I don't know. There's all these pieces that you second guess, especially when someone's dying. You absolutely don't know what to do because the reality is They're very normal days in an abnormal time. So you're sitting there with someone's dying, and someone says, "You know, what do you want for lunch? Do you want pizza or macaroni?" And you think, I don't know. Like, should I eat macaroni when my sister's dying? Like, do people eat when people are dying? You know, it's just this profound sense of being completely uncertain. One of the big questions that I see come up all the time is it okay for me to go home? Should I leave? And you know, dear wonderful palliative care nurses and support staff get this all the time. Should I go out for supper? Should I stay? You know, should I take a break? Should I not? And you just kind of don't know. And all those things are so normal too, that profound indecisiveness in the valley.
Now, one of those areas of imperfection, or what some people feeling like you're making mistakes, that you talk about is in the chapter Room for Imperfect Goodbyes. You say, we need room for the story of our loved ones' last moments to not be ones of closure or poignancy. And I think this is something that movies and TV have convinced us are going to happen when it's done right. You're going to have this perfect, poignant closing moment. It's all just going to be made right. It's all going to be wrapped up in a tidy little ribbon at the end of 22 and a half minutes. And life doesn't work that way, does it?
This is the number one chapter I get comments about, hands down.
Really?
A number of podcasts, this is the one that people go, this one stood out to me, especially if they the loved one in that way where, you know, they knew it was coming. Again, because it's hard to compare to someone who had a sudden loss and they actually didn't get that goodbye. And that's so hard too. But that also needs space, right? It needs space to be like, that sucks that, you know, you said, see you tonight, and then you didn't, right? That's awful. So this has been a very shaping idea for a lot of people. And you know, I could go off on this, to be honest. I hate death scenes in movies and TV shows. And my kids know it. Sometimes we'll watch something and go, okay, mom, say it. And I'll go, it's not always like that. And there's this idea that we have that a good goodbye is, you know, they drift away slowly. And everyone also thinks that there's gonna, not everyone, but of course, many think there's gonna be this moment where they're all going to be able to, like, they're going to sit up in bed, they're going to say, I love you, Carl, I love you, blah, 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 and then they'll kind of drift away. The reality is, if someone dies after a long illness, more often they're sedated or on heavy medications near the end, not enabling them to do that. And when they were well enough to do that, they might not have been in the mental space to do it. The reality is that sometimes they are very weighed down with the burden of dying. And I would say this even with people who may, in our modern age, actually have chosen when they die, which you can do in Canada. And even then, there's so many things that are complicated about that. This idea that we can just control how the goodbye would look, it's not always the case. And so we have this idea that we're going to be able to have this really special conversation, that it's going to be really tidy, that we're just going to see them very gently sort of have this moment that we can just really be there. And it's not always like that. In fact, it's rarely like that. And I've been at a lot of deathbeds, and I haven't seen a single deathbed that looks like TV. Let me stress that again, not one. Scene is someone leaving the room and the person dies in the 5 minutes they're gone, and the person comes back completely overwrought. I've seen the person 2 or 3 days completely nonverbal, and when they slip away, people, like, they don't even realize they've died. I see people who have passed away that are kind of wrestling near the end, and they're not at peace in the way we want to be them to be at peace. And they're wishing things were different, and they're still frustrated, and people wish they had this kind of embodiment of peace. I've seen really traumatic losses where there's a sudden change in health or something physically painful or really traumatizing that people watch, and they're quite traumatized by that death. And so when we carry the narrative of what a goodbye should be, it can be really painful for us because we feel cheated. I think it's okay to lament that we wish the goodbye had been different, that we wish we'd had the TV goodbye. But I need to make space to realize our goodbyes, they're just what they were. They were as they were. And sometimes find that space maybe to create the goodbye that we didn't have. And that's sometimes what we do at funerals or maybe at a graveside or even months later at some moment that we find we're able to say to the person, even if they're not physically next to us, what we wish we could have said. So that's what I mean by making room for imperfect goodbye. I wish people understood that is so normal. And I've only become more convinced with that since the book came out, because it comes up so often with people saying to me, "That's what happened to me with my dad. That's what happened to me with my son. That's what happened to me with my friend." And I felt so guilty. I felt so cheated. Oh, like I'd done something wrong. When really, it just is how it is.
No, I appreciate that very much because, yeah, I'm the same way. As you said, you've never seen the perfect closure goodbye TV moment happen in actual real life. I haven't seen it either. I've heard of situations where something like that has been there and it's been a profound moment for them. But 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100 or more, you end up going, oh, the last thing I said to them was this, or the last thing they said to me was this. I can't believe, because of all the things, all the emotions that are being struggled with. And it is more likely that the last thing you say to them or the last thing they said to you is going to be either neutral and pedestrian or inappropriate than it's going to be profound.
Again, assuming this is someone who maybe died after a long illness, the reality is if they're coherent enough to say something really meaningful to you, that means their death has come a bit more sudden than you anticipated, right? Because again, like say a death with cancer, if they are being appropriately medicated to manage the pain, they likely are sleeping a lot near the end. And I don't think we always put those pieces together, right? That when someone is really able to articulate in that deeply meaningful way, it probably means that they're not that near the end yet. Or if they are, it means something changed really quickly. And I don't say this to like undermine those type of deaths, because I'm sure there's people listening going, "Well, it happened to me. I'm so glad." But often people really do feel that sense of really being cheated. And I want to say, first of all, it's okay to lament feeling cheated and frustrated. And I hope you'll know that there's room for your goodbye to be meaningful. I know I shared this story at some point recently, and I was thinking back to a TV show I saw years ago. The show is How I Met Your Mother. Some people might have seen it through the years, but there's an episode that they share clips of on TV all the time, because there's a season where a character named Marshall's father dies, and he would have been in his late 20s. He dies of a heart attack. They do a great that scene. I've seen it on my Insta threads tons, with grievers sharing the scene when he hears his father died. They didn't actually tell the actor they were going to do that, so they got a really authentic reaction. And he goes, "I'm not ready for this." So it's really profound. But in the next episode, because I love watching things about grief and learning from them, he's really upset because he listens to a voicemail from his father. And in the voicemail, he's like, "These are my dad's last words." And everyone else has these amazing last words from their dad. Like they have these really meaningful last words. And when he listens to his voicemail, his dad says, "By the way, have you watched Crocodile Dundee 3? It really holds up." And he's really upset about this. He's, "I can't believe these were my dad's last words." Well, what's interesting is the episode ends, is he listens again, and then there's like a bit of static, and he realizes there was more to the message. And he says, "Oh, sorry, I was still on the phone there." And I can't remember exactly what it was, but something like, "I love you." And he says, "Oh, my dad's last words were, I love you." But then it cuts to the funeral, and each of them are sharing their last words. And he says, "And my dad's last words to me were, 'Have you watched Crocodile Dundee 3? It really holds up.'" And the room laughs. And I love that scene, because it's this moment of realizing actually that first goodbye was really beautiful in its own way. It speaks to the relationship, it speaks to something profound about this person. And it was actually so special to him that he ended up wanting to keep that part of the story. I think that is a great analogy of often what happens in our goodbye.
Plus, most of us don't go through every moment of every day being profound and articulate. So, what's the likelihood that we're going to be that at that point either? It's probably going to be much more mundane and everyday for all of us because that's how every day is for us. So you talk about one of your chapters is room for the grief bubble. Tell us a little bit, what's the grief bubble?
It's not an official term. It's one that I started using for myself because I found it to be true. And I often also compared it to like walking around with an astronaut helmet on. And I felt like I was living in a bubble where the rest of the world was just slightly outside me. And when I talk to grievers in the earliest seasons of their grief and when their grief is most profound, I think it's an accurate description of what people often feel. This sense that there's a distance between themselves and everybody else. You are actually swimming in your grief. Your grief is on your mind all the time. I think it's important to understand that as grievers, how normal that is. that all you're seeing is a lens of grief. But it's also important for those of us who want to support grievers to understand that the grievers are in a grief bubble. Because sometimes we will say things like, I didn't want to say anything to them because I didn't want to remind them, friend, there's no such thing. They think about it all the time. They live in a grief bubble. When you bring it up, you just enter the bubble with them for a moment. When we remember that they are living in this constantly, all the things you're saying, all the things you're framing, they are seeing through a lens of grief. And that sense of feeling very isolated from others is really normal when you're grieving.
Yeah. So again, and your solution is leave room for people to do that. Another thing you talk about that I think is one of these things that we are avoidant of in our culture is room for regret. You know, we live in a no regrets culture. I mean, it's just you know, regrets I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention, right? We put it in songs. We hate regret so much. But one of the things you say in it is that you found yourself grieving things that never happened, things that will never be. Talk to us about, because that's part of the process. As one of the things that I remember about that chapter is as important anniversaries and events come along, and it's your first one without them, those kinds of things. Walk us through that process and how important that is to leave room for.
When we're grieving, anyone who grieves, no, you don't just grieve the things you lost. You grieve the things you hoped for. You grieve the things that might have been and that would have been. And so when someone loses a child, they don't just think about the 10-year-old that they lost. They grieve for the 20-year-old that they'll never meet. They grieve for the wedding that they won't get to witness. They grieve for the teenage years that they won't live through. And all of those things are so profound. And so deep. And it can be really confusing for when we're grieving to feel like, why am I grieving something that didn't exist? But it is a sense of loss. And that I use the term regret to describe that, as well as just other regrets we might have had. We will look back when we grieve. Every single one of us, I'm going to be that unequivocal about it. And we're going to say, I wish I'd spent more time with them. Or I wish I'd done this. I wish I'd said that. I regret that I didn't say this. I regret that I didn't go to that event. I regret that I didn't buy them this gift last Christmas. They always said they wanted it. Processing that is a normal part of grief. Making room to name that is normal. And it's okay to regret those things. It's okay to wish maybe things had been different. Maybe that we regret that we didn't heal relationships that could have been healed. And it's also normal to regret what wasn't. And so we also need to make space for that regret for the things that we won't have, that we wish we had. And so remembering that our grievers are also going through that. They're not just grieving the thing that they had immediately lost. They're grieving all the things that are going to come up that they won't have. When I was at one of my grieving events not so long ago, I talked to a couple who had lost their only son who had died by suicide. They were devastated, of course. He was in his mid-20s. And they said to me, Leanne, can we tell you one of the hardest things? We're never going to be grandparents. And so they were grieving grandchildren that would never. And I said, of course you are. And they said, you know, all our friends are becoming grandparents, and that's never going to happen for us. And so this was such a profound loss. And we need to make room for that regret. And in that moment, making room doesn't look like saying, but think of all the other wonderful things in your life. It doesn't look like saying, oh, there's other children at church that you could become adopted grandparents to. Room for that regret looks like saying, that must feel like such a big loss. I'm so sorry. There might be time later to share those other things, but making them have room for that regret, I think is really important.
Yeah, that's huge. In that idea of these things that we will never experience because we've lost a loved one, this is one of the reasons how we get to one of your important chapters right near the end is how to give people room when they're not, quote unquote, getting over their grief. In fact, I want to talk about that in our bonus material because I think it's important, but it can stand alone. So anybody who's interested in that, and especially if you're a pastor and you've experienced walking people through and they can't seem to get over it, how do you help them in that situation? How do you give them room to be okay not getting over it? Because there's going to be things that are always going to be missed out on and so on. So how do you deal with that? So if you're interested in that, you can get that in one of two ways. All of the bonus content that we ever produce for any of these podcasts, you can go to karlvaders.com/support. And if you become a regular partner financially, you'll get a bunch of bonus things, including all the bonus content. Or if you just want the bonus content from the podcast, go to karlvaders.com/subscribe. Subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You get a free one every Friday. And the links to the bonus content are only available to our supporters and our subscribers. And we're going to talk, especially to pastors, about how to help people who don't seem to be getting over their grief and how do you give them room for that to take place. But before we start to bring this in for a landing and get to the lightning round questions for you, you say if you're supporting a grieving friend, one of the greatest gifts you can give is the room to talk about it. How important it is it to just give people the space to be able to say what they need to say, even if they don't know what they want to say?
Often grievers are just aching to talk. Now, I don't want to say that some people you're going to bring it up, they're going to say, I don't want to talk about it. Of course, some listening are going to say, I didn't want to talk about it. But we do need to give people space to talk because in my experience, most do want that space. And that looks like lots of things. I know for me, the ability to just talk about what happened the day she died, it was traumatic. I had lived through trauma. I watched my sister die in front of me. For many, especially if you're pastors, you've got to realize a congregant has just experienced something completely earth-shattering. And so they're processing that. And they might need to tell the story again and again if they're able, or other pieces of that story, how they first heard, what they've gone through, a tension they had with someone. They want to name it, but they also want to talk about their person. And one of the profoundly painful things for grievers is feeling like their loved ones disappeared from everyone else's life. People aren't saying their name. They're avoiding talking about them. And so the ability to just say, tell me what they were like. Tell me what you're feeling. And so I think it's an incredible gift to meet with a griever. And pastorally, I always tried to do this a couple months in and just say, what do you want to talk about? Tell me what it's been like. Tell me what you're going through. And I will say, recognizing we're talking to pastors, the reality is you're not going to hear anything new. You're going to hear a story that sounds like every other griever's story, except it's going to have profoundly unique nuances because every story, I always say grief is so universal and it's unique. And this is this strange line we walk. The grief experience is absolutely universal, but every grief is special and every grief is unique. And so you're going to hear something, you're going to say, yeah, this is what grievers go through. But yet for them, we need to make space for that unique story to be absolutely profound. Absolutely the first time we've ever heard it. So we've talked to others whose mothers have died. And, you know, we could give a million thoughts on how that can look. But for this person, this is the first mother they've had die. And their experience of going through that is so unique and life-shaping to them that the ability to talk about it is a great gift.
Well, I hope and pray that the time that we've given you today to talk through it has given you space, given you room to process your grief for the loss of your sister Roxanne as well. Sometimes just being able to do that and to talk it through again, hopefully is a healing process. But before we let you go to that and we record the bonus content, let's go through the lightning round questions. I got four questions that everybody gets. All right. Question number one, what are the biggest changes you've seen in your field of ministry in the last few years and how have you adapted to them?
Well, I have two different fields. So I was a pastor for 18 years. The last 2 years, I am actually the executive minister of my denomination, which is a Baptist family of 300 churches in Ontario. So I'll answer for the latter. A significant change is the change in how people, the amount of people becoming pastors and how they're becoming pastors. So this is a huge change that I think many of our churches need to understand. And we're seeing certainly across Canada. And that is that the traditional method of someone doing their undergrad and then maybe doing a master's or a biblical college undergrad and then right into ministry and then getting their first church and, you know, maybe doing an associate or youth role and then stepping into lead pastor. We're just not seeing that very often anymore. First of all, we're seeing way less people go into pastoring. That has dramatically decreased. And I think we can have lots of conversations about why that is and how we could talk about the call and the joy of pastoring more and how churches can be making pastoring a more positive experience for many people. But there's this reality that now a lot more pastors are coming from second career. We need to see churches that are willing to build up lay pastors and lay leadership and people that can be supportive in that way, especially in our small churches. And people coming from other countries who are settling in and are coming in particular to Canada and our regions. I can speak to that and saying, we're excited to be serving the church and how we can be helping engage those pastors. So that's been a really significant change. Another huge change that we're seeing in churches that's impacting everything is, of course, this rise of the nuns and duns. I know many of your listeners are American. In Canada, the fastest growing religion, I believe it's also in the US, risen to 34% since our last census, is nuns. I'm no religion. And so this shift culturally, you know, when you're talking to older generations at your church or people who've grown up in church, and they're saying, you know, we're all the young people. They should come to church. Helping people understand that that should of church has just died. It's just not culturally the norm anymore. And what that means to be shaping our churches, I think, is quite significant.
We need to give people grieving room for the loss of their churches as well. I think that's going to be something that's going to be huge in the next generation or two.
Yes. And sometimes when churches close, and there's all kinds of grief that's needed in that. And again, to pastor well in this era, you actually have to help people grieve that. They have to grieve that this has changed. And so sometimes it's so pastoral to just be naming, yeah, you're right. This has really changed and it's really hard. And we see it, grieve it. We need to make space for it. So it doesn't help to just be flippant about it, right? It doesn't help to be like, get with the times, figure it out. It's changed, because there is great grief and loss for people in that role. And that includes our pastoring role, right? Many of us, depending on what season you're pastoring in, we have seen how pastoring's been viewed change dramatically in several decades. And if some of us started in ministry 20, 30, 40 years ago, there was a time when pastors were respected, their voice mattered in the community, and that has changed. And some of us feel adrift in what our role is as pastors. And that's something to grieve too.
Yeah, very, very true. Yeah. Question number two, what free or cheap resource like an app or website has helped you lately that you'd recommend for small church ministry?
I would really encourage people to connect to the Small Church Network, which is a great group of churches. So the Small Church Network has support for churches. They do retreats for small church pastors. And I think all that can be really helpful.
Terrific. Number three, what's the best piece of ministry advice you've ever received?
There's so many I could pick, but I love that one I shared earlier, actually, that, you know, you step into the room and you trust that God's gone ahead of you, and you say, God, help me see you. And you have to step in saying, Holy Spirit, guide me in this moment. Am I, whether I'm stepping into a room with a griever, I'm stepping into a room with someone dying, I'm stepping into a conflict, I'm stepping into a board meeting, I'm showing up at church on Sunday, God, you're already here. Help me see you and help me be led by your spirit in this moment. There's been many times I've forgotten that. And the times that I pause and remember have been very, very meaningful reminders of how important it is.
Yeah, wonderful. Last one. What's the funniest or weirdest thing you've ever seen in church?
Oh, there's so many. I'm actually going to do one that I just saw last week because I could pick tons, but this was just this week. And I was sitting in church. I now attend the church I once pastored, and they have a new pastor. And he preaches a little bit longer than the church is used to. They're adjusting, and he jokes about it. And it was an absolutely delightful moment. And he was sharing about different ways we experience God. And he said, you know, I really connect through learning and through studying and through engaging in that way. And he said, I know, you know, so for me, you know, a sermon is really where I feel God's presence. And he said, I know that's not true in the same way for all of you. And a gentleman just about three rows over, older adult with cognitive delays, said extremely loudly, no, it isn't. And the whole back section of the church just lost it. And I felt so bad for this pastor because I could tell he didn't know what we were laughing at. And I just, there's so many. And I just thought, oh man, I could laugh thinking like church is such a delight. And I said to him after, I said, this is what happened. We weren't laughing at you. But there's so many. I mean, I grew up in Newfoundland with testimony periods, which is where anyone could get up and say things. We want to get going, we laugh. And I still laugh when I remember some dear woman getting up, and often for testimony periods, people would quote a song. And she said with a completely straight face, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Church is wonderful. Aren't churches just wonderful?
I don't know if that was that a mistake or a confession. I don't know.
I think her whole life she just thought it was witch.
Yeah, that's probably the what it was.
Just as you know. And so church is just such a delight, right? You just have these
Yeah.
moments we laugh. And so, but that was that when I first shared. That just happened recently, and we took a while to recover because he said it so vehemently.
Yeah.
And it
That's
was
great. That's
delight.
great. Yeah, I love that one. We're going to pause and then we're going to go into the bonus content again. We'll put the links in the show notes of how you can get all the bonus content if you want. We're going to talk about, as pastors, how do we help people and give them room when they're not, quote, getting over their grief. But if people want to reach out to you to get any information or follow up with anything, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
I encourage you to check out my Instagram page. I will confess it's gone a little bit dormant for a few months. I'm looking forward to reviving it in the weeks to come. I had a really busy season in my life, but at grieving.room on Instagram. And you can also go to my website, leannefriesen.com, which again does need some updating, but also you can get my contact information there.
Got it. All those links will be in the show notes. Leanne, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Well, grief is hard. That is not the most profound statement ever uttered, but it's certainly one of the truest. Grief is hard, and we don't like facing hard things. So, as Leanne mentioned, we often spend more time avoiding them than dealing with them. But one of the most profound truths that I've learned as a pastor, and quite simply as an adult, is that the longer we delay dealing with hard things, the bigger and more difficult they become. So, if you're dealing with unprocessed grief, first of all, I hope this episode has helped you. Secondly, pick up Leanne's book for even more help to do it well. And finally, if you are a pastor or you're in any position where you're helping people process through their grief, give them the room to do that, but also make sure that you're processing the toll that it takes on you when you walk with people through those difficult seasons. One of the characteristics about Jesus that we learn from Scripture is that he was acquainted with grief, so we know that he will walk with us through our grief as well. This episode was produced by Veronica Beaver. It was edited by Phil Vaders. Original theme music was written and performed by Jack Wilkins of jackwilkinsmusic.com. The graphic design is by Solomon Joy. And me, I'm Carl Vaders, and I hope to talk with you again in the church lobby.